session number 14963, Reel 1.
Mr. Wakeman, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
Well, I was born in Gravesend, 1918.
And what did your father do for a living?
Oh, my father, he was an ex-soldier from the First World War, Royal Fusiliers. And during the war, from about 1900, they had had a small confectionery news agency in Swanscombe. And he always felt keen on cycles, so my mother took over a cycle shop in Gravesend, and 6 months later I was born after he came out of the service. That was about 1918.
Did you go to school in Gravesend?
Yes, yes.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
When I finished the schooling was 16, 15 and a half, 16.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I did get a job. To start with, I hadn't. We had a lot of... it's a time of depression, 1930s. There wasn't a lot going. There was not a lot of work. I was at the art school, and I was very keen on art, and I should have stayed there. But this wasn't possible. I knew what was going on at home. They were short of money. There was no business. There was nothing coming in. So I thought I had to contribute the money into the house. So I started out and got a job. First off, I went to a local engineer. We lived in Gravesend on the river. All of our aspects was sea and water, canals and things of that sort. So we loved iron, heavy industry. I got a job which I thought would be nice. Local engineers on a canal basin, ship repairers, boat repairers, you name it, they'd got it. But I lasted one day, mainly because I went there and a chap had lost his assistant, and I was put as a plater's assistant on this heavy engineering stuff straight from art school. And by the lunchtime, my hands were bleeding and torn. By the end of the day, I was exhausted. And all for about, well, today's money, about a penny an hour. It was tuppence halfpenny an hour in those days. And that just went home that night, covered in filth and dirt, iron dust. I have enough of that. I'm not going there anymore. And I just finished it the next day, next morning.
What were you doing when war broke out?
When war broke out, I'd then gone through an apprenticeship I'd sorted out for myself on engineering, motor engineering, and engines in particular. And I went to Short Brothers, Aeronautical Builders on the Medway. It's something I'd tried to get years ago because I'd always been keen on aeroplanes and ships, the two together. So I got this job at Short's, and we were lucky. This was, what, early 1939, late 1938, after the Czechoslovak crisis. That would be early 39, I suppose. I went to Short's, and I had a job with the engineering, engine installation department, working on Sunderland's and the Empire boats. Now, George Cotton, he was the chief engineer. He did the interview with me. He was a droll character. He obviously thought well of what he saw in me, or he thought I'd make the numbers up, I don't know. But he said, have you got any tools? I said, yes, I've got full tools. I've served an apprenticeship. Good, he said, you only need a pair of pliers on this job. So I started work then on the engine installation. Put around with a few fellows there who knew the work. Obviously, they'd been ex-Royal Flying Corps and ex-Royal Navy. They knew all about these big engines on the Sunderlands. I didn't. But so I stayed with those. We worked on that a few months later, I suppose. I was cast adrift free to do what I wanted this job. That's what I was doing when that war actually broke out. I was sitting on the slipway on the Monday morning with the beautiful blue sky, sun shining, the water tightening up the air screws of one of the Sunderlands that was about to be handed over to the Air Force. I remember that quite well.
So you were doing Sunday work?
Yes, we were doing Sunday, but I wasn't working the Sunday the war broke out. I was at home. And I remember it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, that dreadful music the BBC put out, a dirge rather. It was, I don't know, the music would have been, I don't know, the death of Nelson would have been a light-hearted, light-hearted composition to listen to it. And suddenly it broke in and Neville Chamberlain came on the phone, came on the on a radio, said that after saying he'd passed a message to Herr Hitler, and if he didn't withdraw by 11 o'clock from Poland, there would, a state of war would exist between us. I have no such message. No sooner he stopped speaking, the sirens went. We heard these sirens because everybody went outside, and the war's on, there's the aeroplanes are coming, but nothing. A lovely blue sky again, nothing happening. Beautiful. And we just went back in again and turned the radio off because he couldn't stand the music any longer. And Mother started getting the dinner ready, getting the lunch ready. Roast beef and Yorkshire, and as usual, we carried on to Sunday lunch and Sunday, no change, nothing happened.
Had you expected war to break out?
Before, say, from a 1933, when I left school, all the papers were carrying stories of Hitler and the Germans, and the whole crisis had moved up to a point where we knew war was coming. When, I didn't know, but we knew it was coming one day. And we grew up with it, and it came into 1938, we expected war, the Munich crisis, 1939, we knew it was coming. But we didn't change. Everything was just the same. Holidays were going on without, what holidays? Week? It was a day at the seaside or something of that sort. But the test match, Wimbledon, you name it, it was a summertime. And when September 39 came, we knew it was going into war, and there was an electric atmosphere everywhere. Nothing, no panic, no concern. It was just going on that we knew it was coming, and now it was here. So that was it. We'd got it. We knew where the future lay.
But did you not feel a sense of dismay when you heard that we were at war?
Oh, we felt a sense of dismay from 1938, from the Munich crisis. We felt Chamberlain and those had let us down. I'm talking about people of my standard and living conditions, not the intelligentsia and not the heavy middle class. I'm talking about the people who I mix with. We felt a sense of letdown that we had betrayed, that we let everybody down. It wasn't dismay. It was dismay in the government, that the attitude. We should have stood up to Hitler then. That's what we felt. And we went on in 1939. We felt, well, now he pushed everybody around. Now they'll start pushing us around. Now, we didn't feel dismay. We felt relief that at last we know it's here, what we've got to face. At least this is only me talking now. I don't know what the... a lot of other people felt differently, I presume.
Now, coming back to Shorts, was the factory in Gravesend?
No, this is at Rochester on the Medway. The seaplane works. We also had the landplane works at Rochester Airport, where they were building Stirlings. We were building Sunderland flying boats. They had been building Singapore boats, but they were finished. We were building Sunderland flying boats and Empire flying boats, which were the Imperial Airways long trial routes, and three massive, what we call G-class boats. They didn't last long. They took them over when war broke out, and they used them as troop carriers in a Norway campaign. But they were shot up and sunk, except for one of them that lasted, I don't know how long it did last, but they were all sunk eventually anyway. There's only three of them built.
Was Shorts in 1939 a good firm to work for or not?
Yes, well, I think they were no better than any other. They weren't any worse, but the work was so interesting. The work suited me. I mean, working in those conditions, we didn't get paid holidays. We didn't get sick pay, or we didn't get any benefits, but the work was so interesting. Everybody was glad of the work and the overtime that was coming with it to make the money up, and we had a decent standard of living from it. They were good employers, no better, no worse than any other big company.
Were there any industrial disputes or strikes whilst you were there?
Yes. It was rather funny, actually. There was just one. After war broke out, of course, strikes were illegal. But I didn't know this. The war hadn't been going on very long, and the word was spread around by the... Because you had to join a trade union, or had to join the Amalgamated Engineering Union to work there, irrespective of your views. Well, I wasn't a union member, but I had to join. And the word went around that the bonus they were paying, and they cut the hours on certain jobs that they couldn't earn any bonus when they worked on it. Well, that didn't apply to the engine people. It applied to the people building the actual boats themselves, the riveters and the platers and people of that sort. And they had started up, and the word went around from the shop stewards that at 11 o'clock, take your lunch break. We always had a 10-minute lunch break then. Take your lunch break, but don't start work again. So why? Oh, you'll find out. And everybody just sat on at 11 o'clock, and even the supervisor in charge were all in on this. They all knew, and they all bought another cup of tea, had another bun, and 11:30, they came out and put the performance through. What's going on? Send for the works convener. And this was called a strike, actually. But it came through by 11:45, back again. Yes, the bonuses will be paid back on the original rates, and we're back where we started. So our strike lasted about 3/4 hour.
So that was soon after war was declared?
Oh, that would be about, I should say about 6 or 7 months after war was declared. Yes, it would be. I can't give you the exact date, I can't remember it.
So it sounds like it was around about March 1940, something like that.
Something like that, yes. Maybe a little later than that.
If you had had the choice, would you have joined the union or not?
No, I wouldn't have joined. I've never been union-minded. I had to join, I wanted to, and that was it. Because I wanted to get onto aeronautical work. I liked aeroplanes, but I had... In 1939, June 1939, registered as a militiaman. Well, I firmly believed, being very naive, obviously, that I'd be called up into the army, as I'd been registered. Though they'd put me down as a preference of Royal Air Force, nobody took much notice of that. We would get one of Chambers' militiamen at a shilling a day or something. Well, when war broke out, nothing happened. And... the nearest thing that happened was in November the 13th. They called me up for a medical at Chatham, and they put me through the medical procedure in the National Service Acts, GRSU and so on, this, that, and the other. All the paperwork dealt with, had a medical, and sent back home again. And I passed A1, fit for anything, fit for all sorts of work, but nothing mentioned about the Army or the Air Force. That was it. Nothing happened. I fully expected to go into the army, but nevertheless, I wanted to get in the Air Force. I couldn't get into that. That was the time when I discovered I was in a reserved occupation. Never heard of it before.
Whilst you were at Shorts, once war broke out, did the declaration of war have much effect on the work at Shorts?
Not a lot. Not immediately. No, we like everybody else, we did expect air raids. Everybody was thinking the air blitz was coming any time. And they had already dug air raid tunnels into chalk cliffs behind the seaplane works. And we had one or two practice alerts to move in, exit us into the tunnel from these the hangars. But no. The work went on for the first few months, went on quite normally, until possibly around May 1940, when we started getting pushed back to the coast in France, the expeditionary force, and they suddenly seemed to take all the aluminium, all the sheeting away from the works there, because it was required for fighter production. So that was the first real indication we had. People were short in the boat builders were short of the derailleur men to make the boats, and they were rationed. And of course, that was a time when we needed fighters, needed fighter construction, and we suffered because of that for a time. And that was the first real indication we had that it was affecting us.
But was there any, once war was declared, was there suddenly increased pressure to get on with the work and to increase production?
No, because this is all laid out. The production was on from before the war on a maximum that it could be. The only thing that did happen was they rapidly finished off the Empire boats and the G-class boats that were there, the civil versions, and didn't put any more on the stocks. They just carried on with Sunderland's flying boats. And, the production was late. They could only fill up so many stocks and so many hangars and slipways. They just couldn't bring any more in. They were there. They're moving along. We were getting a supply of engines from Bristol and the air screws from de Havilland, and they were in stock anyway. And, it was there.
Did you have in the works some kind of propaganda, like posters and so on, to encourage you to work well because of the war effort?
No more than we had outside. The one that did strike a note with us once, it was rather funny. I think it was about Christmas 39. Yes, Christmas 39. But a lovely big poster on the wall there with a beautiful picture of a Sunderland. On a diving onto a sunlit sea, and the Sunderland, they're all pure white, and the sun glinting on its wings, and it's underneath it said, "Peace on earth and goodwill to all men," and it had its bomb racks sprung out on the wings, which had to be wound out from the fuselage, and that rather struck a note of amusement among everybody. Peace on goodwill with this one thing already drop its bombs, you know. Yes, that did strike a note of amusement among everybody. But apart from that, there was nothing. It was later in the war, the usual security things, don't talk about your work, or keep mum like dad, those sort of silly posters.
Did you forbid the security provisions?
Oh, I think so, because it was brought home to us all during the Battle of Britain. I mean, we were getting all these fights overhead, and we were getting bombed, and things were, people were very security conscious. I didn't think there any doubt whatsoever. We felt pretty close to the Germans in North Kent there,
Did your work change during the time you were at Shorts? Did you progress?
You could say I became qualified as an engine installation fitter, an air screw fitter, and a hydraulic systems engineer. I suppose, yes, because I had my own, by the time I left, I had my own people with me, where I was the leading person in the gang, as it were, doing this, I didn't go on to drawing of it and all that sort of thing, because I wanted one thing, and that was to get away from it. I wanted to get into the Air Force.
Would you say it was an efficient factory or not?
It was, put it this way, it wasn't efficient in the way that factories progressed 20 years after the war, but it was efficient in the way they had worked between the wars. Too much work, in my mind, was being carried out by hand, or it could be done by machines, but there weren't the machines to do it, but we had the craftsmen to do it by hand. This particularly applied to the, as we call them, tin bashers, the metal workers. They were craftsmen, and they shaped and bent and knocked and hammered these sheets into shape, whereas really, if we had got the machinery that they had in the car factories at that time, they could have been stamped out. Yes. So as far as the equipment and stuff was concerned, it was not efficient, but it the gear that they had, they were as efficient as you could be.
Were you happy at Charlotte's?
Well, that's relative, really, because I was happy in what I was doing. I was enjoying it, particularly things when we were doing engine runs out in the slipway and things of that in a nice way. But I wanted to get into the Air Force, so that made me unhappy, really, in as much as that it was an underlying thought. It wasn't so much that I was unhappy in the work I was doing, because I just liked the aeroplanes and what I was doing with them.
Did you have any women working there?
Oh, yes, lots of, plenty of girls working there. Not on our type of work that we were. No, we didn't have any there. But there were girls working in the detail shops, making up the small parts and things, and the wings, the ribs and the stringers and things of that sort, you know. I presume later, after I left, they did get more, but of course I left in 1941.
Had those girls traditionally worked on those jobs pre-war?
No, they were just girls coming in instead of going into services.
You mean conscripted?
Yeah.
How did you come to leave Shorts?
Well, I did hear from somebody that if one got a release note from the company you were working for, yes, you could get away from them. There was no other way of getting out of employment there. So I pestered them for a release note to get into the Air Force, and I think they got fed up with me eventually, and they agreed to give me a release note. But what I made a mistake, and I didn't realise that a release note from that company was only releasing me from there to take up employment in another aeronautical job somewhere. And I was too naive to realise this. I thought it was releasing me. So I got away from there, but then when I did get away, I thought I had this note in my hand, and I thought, this is wonderful. Now, in the meantime, I had been, which I rather missed out telling you about this, I had been up to Uxbridge, the Air Force, and I'd got through to my medical and my aircrew reception, and I with this release note, and I was sent there, and I did my ground exams at the initial 3 days I spent there, and then I got a rail warrant back home. Well, you go back home, we can't accept you because you're in reserved occupation. Now, I've got this release note with me, and they still told me I was in the reserved occupation. So I went home, and that was 1941, I suppose, winter of 1940, winter of 1941. And went back and found that, well, I'm not going back to Shorts, so I should never get away again. So I went to report it to the local labour exchange and put the position to them. They were sympathetic. They understood. They said, well, you might as well do something. So you go to, they gave me a company there, you go to them and tell them what you're doing, and we'll see what we can do for you from here. And I thought that was very good. So they sent me to Bowaters. Now, we'd had some heavy bombing raids at Gravesend that summer, 1940. And Bowaters had been bombed completely. But there, one shop that was making the maintenance shop of the paper mill, as they were paper makers, were making Bofors gun carriages, and mounting and refurbishing old guns from the First World War, big howitzers. So they sent me there. I told them position. They were quite happy to do to accommodate me. And
Where is Bowaters?
That's in Gravesend. Well, Northfleet, actually, but it is Gravesend to all intents and purposes. It's on the riverfront there. And we had a lot of raids during the Britain, and that was just a passing phase for me. We went there, and I stayed with them, quite enjoyed it, actually. The air raids were a bit of a nuisance at night and day, because you'd go and some funny things happened with that. I had a motorbike at the time to go to and fro to work, and that was rather amusing in so many ways. You used to have petrol Cubans, to get the petrol for it, and it would never go very far, but a gallon a month, I think. So I used to empty the paraffin out the primer stove at home into the tank, and help me out with that. It was always packing. I mean, it was good fun anyway. I remember running up to the pub one night with somebody else on the back, with this engine stopping and starting while the air raid was on, and we could hear the bombs coming down on Gravesend, Northfleet, and we just couldn't get away from it. But it was funny. But anyway, that's just drifting on a little. I stayed there, and then the Air Force, the government, decided they were short of air crew. They would have to release people from reserved occupations into the air crew categories of the Air Force. And that brought me into, I'd already written to the Minister of Labour, Ernest Bevin, and I had a letter back from him, which I've got in a book, in a file there. And they immediately sent me a note to report to Weston-super-Mare for induction of air crew, which I did.
Just before we go on further with the RAF, I'd like to go back to Beau Waters. As I understand it, Beau Waters was a paper firm, wasn't it?
That's right. They were a newsprint for all the Fleet Street paper newspapers.
But they'd been converted to making guns?
They'd been bombed out. They'd been smashed up, and the maintenance workshops were still intact, and they used that for refurbishing guns, because after all, if you're an engineer, one thing to another doesn't make any difference. But the actual paper machinery was in good order, but the roofs had been blasted off the terrific great long sheds. They had these calendar rolls and things and rollers to make the paper. All that was destroyed on the roofs and the buildings, but the machinery was good. And the machinery in the maintenance workshops was quite good. So it's only a matter of really using the equipment they've got there.
And what job did you have?
I had a job of assembling the brake system, the hydraulic brakes, because they thought I knew something about that. The hydraulic brakes on the wheels of the undercarriages to these gun carriages, building them up and fitting them.
How did you like it as compared with shots?
I didn't like it at all.
Why not?
Well, it's not. It's too much like mass production. There was no craftsmanship in it. It was just a matter of assembling it. And this was the sort of work I'd done as an apprentice. But they had all trainees there, so that job itself was quite good in effect, as we had a target and we were getting them out, producing these things. And they all were trainees doing the actual assembly of the main gun carriages.
Do you think that engineers and people working in this kind of factory in the war were better off because of the war?
I wouldn't say they were better off. I think they had long hours, had dirty conditions to work under. They're very tiring. A lot of them were doing 12-hour shifts, 8 till 8, both day and night. They were better off financially. They were getting far more money than they ever had before. But I don't think they were better off. I don't think mentally they liked it very much. They liked the money that they were picking up naturally. And, of course, a lot of them, remember, were people from the First World War doing this, or people that weren't fit for the services. Or some had special skills that they could use.
So they were getting more money, but yes, they were also being more tired.
Well, yes, the money, you see, was by the long hours they were working. I mean, 12-hour shifts at Beau Waters was enough to kill anybody, really. Most of them looked pasty-faced and washed out. They went on at 8 in the morning, came off at 8 that night. On the next week, they'd be on 8 that night till 8 the following morning. And it was, and of course, in between, there's no fresh air, it's all artificial lighting.